Let's start with the root, because there's a lot. And by the way, just so everybody knows, we have over 30 people who have signed up to speak tonight. So I am going to ask again, Mr. Quinlan, that the answers be direct and as succinct as possible. So these questions are generally about the root. First one is, what is the expected lifespan of the towers?
The transmission infrastructure is a long-lived asset. From an accounting perspective, it's a 40-year life. Typically, transmission infrastructure lasts much longer than that. Could be 60 or 70 years.
The next questions involve the decommissioning. What numbers has Northern Pass stated in its application for the time required to remove the towers and restore the land to good views and sound conservation, for the cost of removal and restoration, for any jobs that might be filled by local labor? How will the cost be allocated among the various parties? Who are the various parties that will provide payment? Those are all, five questions basically about your decommissioning.
So just at a high level, just so we're clear, and this is a commitment we've made long ago and we continue to honor it, which is that neither the construction of this project nor its ultimate decommissioning will be paid for by New Hampshire customers, okay? So there are a series of agreements between us and our partner, Hydro-Québec, that provide the funding for the project, including the decommissioning. But in both cases, New Hampshire customers won't bear any of that cost. Mr. Bose is our Vice President of Engineering. Did you want to add something, or Mr.?
I think there was some questions about how resources would be allocated at the end of 60 or 70 years. That would be determined at the end of life, not at this point in time.
The other question was, do you have an idea how long it would take to remove the towers?
Sure. It would be probably a few days for each site to actually physically remove the structure, and then there'd be a remediation done for the foundation areas. So over the course of probably 3 to 4 weeks at each location.
Okay, and then the other question, Mr. Quinlan, was about if jobs will be filled by local labor for decommissioning.
We've not determined how we would source the decommissioning. You know, our anticipation is, you know, that's a decision we'll make 50 or 60 years from now. You know, our commitments around using local labor are for construction purposes, although, you know, I suspect, particularly here in the North Country, there's plenty of demolition contractors who can help play a role in that ultimate decommissioning process. It would make sense to look first there, but that's something we wouldn't decide for a number of decades.
Okay, the next question involves a specific point along the route. What will transition station number 5 in Bethlehem look like, including types of structures, their size, and foundation? And please provide information about the size of laydown and staging areas, construction time, and the extent of blasting.
Okay. I'm going to defer that question to Sam Johnson. Sam is with Burns and McDonald. They are doing the engineering and design work around the project. There's a lot of questions there, and for us to be succinct is going to be challenging, but we'll hit the high-level
questions.
Please do your best. Go ahead.
Okay, we'll start with the transition station in Bethlehem. Typically, these are too loud?
Slow down.
Oh, I'm sorry. Slow down. Okay. typically, these transition stations are about 200 by 300 feet in a square-type profile. There will be an A-frame structure, of which a takeoff of conductor will go to the overhead portion, and a transition down to the underground section will occur within this fence line. It'll be a fairly typical substation type of look with a fence and a gravel surface around the equipment. There will be screening around each of these properties, or not only in Bethlehem, but all of the transition stations that will provide some screening from a visual perspective. Laydown areas was the next question.
Yes, laydown areas and then construction time and blasting.
Okay. Laydown areas will actually be dependent on where they are. They will most likely range from 2 acres to upwards of 5 to 10 acres. It really depends on the site conditions of where they're located and the type of property they are. For instance, if it's an old warehouse that we're using for indoor storage, it could be upwards of 100,000 square feet type of facility. And they will be interspersed throughout the project area. Obviously, when you're storing material, the closer you can get it to the actual construction site, the better it is from a transportation perspective. And I apologize, the last.
Blasting.
Blasting is permitted by law within the state as long as you comply with the appropriate blasting protocols. We do plan on blasting in certain locations where we do find hard rock. This is the Granite State for a reason. But that will be governed by the appropriate authoritative responsibility and done by the appropriately permitted contractors.
Okay. Thank you. The next two questions involve the route as well and the height of the poles along the route. They both kind of say the same thing. So basically, these questioners are asking, they're making statements, but they're asking whether or not I'll just read one of them, and the other one's pretty much the same. The proposal to erect 120-plus foot towers down the entire length of the state is simply preposterous to New Hampshire residents. These giant towers are required due to the high voltage proposed for this line. Would Eversource consider a lower voltage wire which would have lower negative impacts on New Hampshire and still deliver benefits to the New England grid? The other question is very similar, except they ask, do you think it is right for creating this ugly scar through the town of Stark?
I'll speak to the heights of structures. Heights of structures are typically determined by two things. One, as was mentioned in the question, is the voltage of the lines. The voltage of the lines were chosen based on an exhaustive study of economics of the project and basically what made sense from a delivery perspective, and that's how we ended up with originally 1,200 and then in the end 1,090 megawatts. The height of the structures, while they're governed by the National Electric Safety Code, they are also governed by topography and right-of-way width. So when we discuss our average height for our DC structures being in the around 85 feet, 80 to 85 feet, that is really based on the national code. Certain heights of other structures are determined by topography and or river crossings and road crossings where the spans have to be somewhat taller or lengthier. I missed one of the questions. Oh, the right-of-way width. So in certain areas, there are constraints within the right-of-way, meaning that there are either other structures or other transmission lines located within a right-of-way. And this, so we may have to go vertical in a configuration in certain circumstances, which would require the structure to be somewhat higher.
Okay, next question is about the COAS loop. How would building the so-called COAS loop in COAS be assisted or not assisted by building the Northern Pass line?
Okay, so as part of the rebuild within the COAS loop, we will be rebuilding the existing 115 line, and that is the structures that we just discussed in Stark, for example. Because those structures were built many, many years ago, we are going to replace them with a more robust system, meaning the electrical capacity of the lines will be increased. That's how this, and we'll connect it into the Paris substation eventually in Dummer. This will allow increased capacity to get out because we're replacing the existing line with a larger conductor.
So by larger conductor, it's a larger diameter wire, greater capacity to carry electric energy.
What are the federal regulations protecting the White Mountain Forest pertaining to preservation of the forest? Why can Northern Pass be permitted to go through the White Mountain Forest?
So as the video indicated, we've made the determination to, in essence, bypass the White Mountain National Forest with underground construction. Now, there's an existing transmission right-of-way through the White Mountain National Forest, an existing 115 kV transmission line through the White Mountain National Forest. That was our previous design, was to run these lines in parallel. As we announced late this summer, based upon feedback we've received from New Hampshire, we've decided to have all of that be underground, bypassing the forest, Franconian Notch, the Appalachian Trail. These are all areas that were identified to us as being important. That resulted in the project being reduced in size by almost 20% and added several hundred million dollars of cost. And we made that decision based upon feedback from sessions such as this and others. Anything to add on?
It is still subject to all permitting, though, federal permitting.
True. But it will be underground in the public way, so essentially along the state highway system.
The next questions are somewhat similar, so I'll lay them all out there for you. The first one is, please explain why Eversource is constructing lines and putting poles along Route 145 in the Clarksville-Stuartstown area. And then the second part of that question is, if Northern Pass is approved, are there plans to use these specific lines to transmit energy from Hydro-Quebec? Then the next question asks about, the proposed route goes through the Forest Society, Kaufman Forest, and Nash Stream State Forest, along with others. What is the purpose of these conservation lands if your company can propose building ugly metal towers through these conservation properties? So those all involve specific places along the route.
Sure, so
Clarksville, Stuartstown, Nash Stream, and Forest Society, Kaufman Forest.
Right, so addressing the Route 145 in Clarksville, the project actually transitions to the underground portion, the 7.5 mile underground portion, just to the west of Route 145, and will actually go across Route 145 underground and then continue south at that point. So the actual crossing of Route 145 is underground. The second question regarding Spinif, and the two state forests that they note, the existing right-of-ways go through both of these properties, and therefore we have the easement rights to put additional structures in these properties and to do improvements within this right-of-way, and therefore we have the rights to build our project.
Okay. Next question is about the route as well. Your proposed route parallels an existing HVDC route from Monroe to Ayer, Massachusetts. Why don't you use this existing route?
Yeah, our route actually does not parallel that. We did look at that corridor as one of our possibilities. However, that corridor is basically built out to its maximum, and we could not use that due to space constraints.
Next question is...
it is worth noting, however, that there are existing transmission infrastructure to essentially do what Northern Pass is intending to do, which is to allow for the importation of large amounts of clean, renewable hydropower. There's the line that was just referred to, and then there's actually a second line that runs through Vermont. This would be the third such line.
Okay, the next question about the route is, if the New Hampshire Department of Transportation does not see it necessary to complete this project, why should we? And can the public see your proposal to the Department of Transportation? Just from the Site Evaluation Committee standpoint, the entire application, except for some limited parts that are subject to a confidentiality request right now, is available, including the applications to DOT, I believe.
Yes.
So I don't know if you have anything to add to that answer.
I don't.
Okay. Who will supply the cables, transfer stations, converter stations, and will the supplier supervise construction?
We have not announced either our major contractors or equipment suppliers. However, we are, as we move into this next phase of planning, basically in negotiations with all of the above, the major contractors, equipment suppliers, and we do anticipate in the coming weeks be in a position to announce how this project is going to move forward, and you know, to whom are we looking for key pieces of equipment. We are not in a position to do so now.
Is it your common practice to have your to have the supplier supervise your construction?
The equipment supplier, not typically. You know, for large transmission projects, likely we'll hire a nationally known general contractor who's really on the construction side. The equipment suppliers tend to be specialists in their given area, whether it's cable or converter technology. They don't typically oversee construction.
Okay. The next question about the route is, why was Franklin chosen to be the site of the converter station? Was it to be a jump-off point to run power lines west to Vermont?
No, actually. We did study a wide variety of sites all up and down that corridor between Franklin and Deerfield. There were two particular constraints. One, we had to have a site that was big enough and a willing landowner that was willing to sell us property. And thirdly, I guess, so three items, a community that was willing to host us, and Franklin certainly has been a very gracious host to this point.
The next questioner has a number of questions, and so I've saved it for last with respect to the route, because some of these questions go into burial. So we'll go right into burial of the line as part of this, just so you're aware. What is the number, average height range, and type of tower planned for your COAS loop upgrade? Given the concerns expressed with visual impact, why hasn't this information, along with visual impact studies and simulations, been provided to the public?
As far as the information being provided, it is part of our application. It is in all of the drawings that have been provided and the maps where each of the structure locations will be. I'm going off the top of my head here, so I'm going to be close, but I believe that our structure heights in the COAS loop will range from 60 feet to 130 feet, depending where you are. And again, that's constrained by either topography or by the amount of items that are already within the right-of-way.
Just so we're clear, is this question pertaining to the loop itself the Northern Pass?
Project? Yes, this questioner has other questions about other parts of the Northern Pass and the route, but that is, I read that question as being with respect to the COAS loop, the upgrade. Yeah. To the upgrade, right. Thank you.
Just want to be clear.
Okay. So the next question is, since the Northern Pass proposed an above-ground route from Bethlehem to Northumberland, Since the Northern Pass proposed above-ground route from Bethlehem to Northumberland was acquired, and in at least one location taken by eminent domain, in order to meet the reasonable requirements of service to the public for one or more 115 kV transmission lines, how does Northern Pass plan to justify siting a 345 kV line not needed for the public good on this right-of-way? I don't know. Do you know what right-of-way
I think this is discussing? It's really a legal question. As our lawyers have looked at our existing property rights, they're confident that we have the legal rights to use those existing properties, which, again, this is an area where there's an existing right-of-way and existing transmission infrastructure for the purpose that we're proposing.
Next question is similar, and you might have a similar answer. How does Northern Pass plan to get around the fact that fiber optic cable is not permitted in the majority of the right-of-way easements yet is necessary for running HVDC lines?
Samer, Ken?
My understanding is that communications and control equipment is integral to the design of the HVDC line. And it's not intended for public use, but only for protection of the circuit itself.
Okay. This one's sort of out of order, but I might as well take it now so I don't lose it. Please explain clearly the relationship between Northern Pass, Eversource, and Hydro-Quebec.
Okay, Northern Pass LLC is a wholly owned subsidiary of Eversource. And there are a series of contracts as between Northern Pass Transmission Company and our partner Hydro-Quebec. In essence, Hydro-Quebec is responsible for building the portion of this line that's in Canada, and they will also be the supply of power and essentially delivery to the border. Northern Pass will then take it down from Pittsburgh to Deerfield.
Okay. There is one historical question here. I'm just going to skip till we get to those. We're now into burial, okay, burial of the lines. The Transportation Act administered by Federal Highways includes a section popularly identified as Section 4F. It directs Federal Highways and its designees to examine project alternatives and select the feasible and prudent project alternative that avoids impact to cultural resources found under the Section 106 process. Doesn't burial under I-93 and other roads, I'm sorry, wouldn't burial under I-93 and other roads be much less likely to impact cultural resources found significant under the Section 106 process, as well as all other resources, such as properties eligible for listing on the Register of Historic Places, which are not eligible for consideration under the Section 106 process?
As to the I-93 alternative, you know, as we've looked at that, we've determined it not to be feasible. We recently filed the basis for that with the Department of Energy, so our position on that is clear. We don't think it's a viable alternative. As to the Section 106 process, maybe Lee Carboneau or Mark, would you want to spend a moment? Make sure, okay. You want to introduce yourself?
Sure.
Succinct.
Good evening, Sherilyn Woodell, Woodell Preservation Services. Underground federal undertaking related to 4F would definitely be subject to Section 106, regardless where it was.
Thank you.
Actually, could you answer the question of whether burial under I-93 is less likely to impact cultural resources?
Not necessarily, because there may be cultural resources that were identified and protected through that process. So it depends. It really does depend.
Okay. All right. And this next one I'm going to take because it's on this. Actually, why don't you come back up? We'll do the historic resource question. In what towns are you considering cultural landscapes as part of your historical review?
Northern Pass has prepared a historic property assessment report, which is posted on our website. And in that report, absolutely cultural resources, cultural landscapes, rural historic districts, even traditional cultural properties were all part of the survey process.
Oh, stay here, because Ms. Monroe just handed me another one right up your alley here. SEC review includes identifying and analyzing the project's impact on historic and cultural resources. These places may be individual structures or large landscapes. Setting and views can be included. What historic and cultural data will be used by the project? I can't read the word, but what is its scope and availability to the public? And how will the Site Evaluation Committee process intersect or not with the federal Section 106 process? Seeking clarity as answers at previous sessions have seemed to evolve. So, do you understand the question? Want me to repeat it?
Yes.
Okay. The questioner first states that SEC review includes identifying and analyzing the project's impact on historic and cultural resources, including individual structures and large landscapes, and that settings and view can be included. What historic and cultural data will be used by the project? I can't read that word, but well, I assume used by the project in its application. What is its scope and availability to the public? And how will the SEC process and the 106 process intersect?
As I had mentioned, I would encourage, if you're interested in the scope and detailed information about historic and cultural resources. The historic property assessment report was completed by Preservation Company and myself. It is very detailed, complete, and the scope of it includes, as I stated, cultural landscapes. Traditional cultural properties were considered. They're no more identified. rural historic districts, single properties, view sheds. That is posted on the website and available for you to take a look at. There is a database that includes 1,248 properties constructed prior to 1968 and detailed information on 194 of those properties that were found likely to be eligible for the National Register. And that is the criteria that is used in adverse effect, which is related to application of that in Section 106.
Intersection of 106 and Site Evaluation Committee? I can answer that.
Yes, okay.
The Site Evaluation Committee is required to consider whether or not the project will have an unreasonable adverse effect on aesthetics and historic sites. We go through our process to make that determination. We are lucky that there is also a 106 process that goes on federally because we get the benefit of that process in almost every docket that we have. Sometimes the Section 106 process goes for a longer period of time than the Site Evaluation Committee process. If a certificate is granted, it is often the case that if the 106 process is still going on, that a condition of any certificate is continued cooperation in the 106 process and following up with any mitigation that may be required by that process. So that's how they intersect. It's two different agencies. 106 is effectuated by the lead federal agency, and the determination by the Site Evaluation Committee is made by the Site Evaluation Committee. However, a lot of the information that is considered is from both processes, at least at the Site Evaluation Committee. I can't speak for the federal lead agency. So we oftentimes see 106 documents and evidence in our Site Evaluation Committee proceedings. Ultimately, the Site Evaluation Committee will make its determination as to whether or not there is an unreasonable adverse impact on historic sites and aesthetics. So, the next question, again, I just want to, there's a lot of questions on here. This one is, doesn't really have to do with historic sites. I don't even know if he's there. Mr. Goetz, a former member of the Site Evaluation Committee and now employed by Northern Pass, wrote in his resume for the Divine Millimet Law Firm, quote, "Most recently I played a key role in efforts to revise the statutes and rules governing the siting of energy facilities in New Hampshire." And the question is, does this refer to the recent rules revision referred to by myself in my presentation on the SEC? I don't know the answer to that question. Do you know the answer?
I don't.
Okay. Moving on, more questions about the burial. Okay, and again, this is an example of really more of a statement than a question, but since the questioner asked it, I'll ask it of you. If the Eversource experts we have here tonight were blessed with a 2016 newborn grandchild and their son or daughter now lived adjacent to the proposed route, would the expert Eversource grandparents propose the route to be above ground or below ground? Experts?
I would prefer overhead transmission line for Northern Pass.
And if I can just say something to the crowd, this is the type of question that is really not meant to get information, okay? It's meant to try to embarrass people. I'm going to ask it, but... you know, it really doesn't move the ball. It really doesn't.
I wrote that question.
Thank you, sir. But I've asked it.
I would like to hear the expert.
You've just heard from two of them.
I want to hear from all.
Sure, go ahead, folks. If you'd like to answer, you don't have to if you don't want to. But if you would like to.
I have pond lines in front of my house. Most people do. That bothers me.
Now I could add to that if you'd like.
Are you an expert?
No.
No, you're not an expert for the Eversource experts, which is what this is.
But I am concerned.
Have a seat. This is not time for statements, sir. Please sit down. Could you explain any potential benefits that could be provided to the economically challenged Coos County from requiring burying the line only in the most critical areas?
Can you repeat that question, please?
Could you please explain any potential benefits that could be provided to the economically challenged Coos County from requiring the burying of the line only in the most critical areas?
So I think I alluded to the balance that we've been trying to strike earlier. We've made a commitment to 60 miles of underground construction. That was based upon feedback from across New Hampshire as to, it was consistent, but where are the areas that we should really focus our limited ability to go underground? If you get to the point where you're, trying to justify a fully underground project, it adds about $1 billion to this project. In our view, it becomes an uneconomic project. At that point, the benefits that we talked about earlier, the roughly $4 billion worth of benefits to the state of New Hampshire, don't materialize. So we've been trying to strike a balance between a project that works economically and addresses the most critical view impacts. And it's largely been based upon feedback from across the state of New Hampshire.
Okay, the next next two questions are very similar. The first one is it possible to bury the line all the way? And secondly is, why don't you spend the extra money and bury bigger cable, and then in 10 or 20 years, you will not have to upgrade to handle more watts? So is it possible to bury the whole line?
It's technically possible to bury the entire line. It is technically possible to do so. Is it a balance that allows the project to move forward and for those benefits to New Hampshire to materialize? In our view, it doesn't, because the cost becomes prohibitive. Could we have continued with a 1,200 megawatt project with the amount of underground construction that we've committed to? The answer is no. When we made the decision to have 60 miles of underground construction, there is no cable in service in this world at 1,200 megawatts for that distance of underground construction. So we necessarily had to reduce the size of the project to 1,090 megawatts to allow the amount of underground construction that we've committed to. And even at that level, it's going to be the longest HVDC underground construction in North America when it's in service. So in our view, we've struck the appropriate balance between a project that works financially, protects the critical view impacts, and technically uses equipment that we know is going to be reliable when we put it in service.
Would spending the money now to bury the cables create a better view aesthetically forever?
Just so we're clear, the additional $1 billion, in our view, makes the project not economic. So the benefits that we talk about don't materialize. The question of, what are the impacts of full burial depends on where you bury it. Some of the initial feedback we've gotten was, just bury it in your existing right-of-way. When we look at the environmental impacts of burying this line through the corridor that we currently, occupy, they're massive. If you think about blasting your way through that existing transmission corridor and attempting to bury this line. While the view impacts ultimately may be less, the environmental impact is significantly greater than what we're proposing. So again, we're trying to strike an appropriate balance.
Please explain in specific terms what you mean by uneconomic when you say you cannot bury the whole line. Do you mean, A, if you bury the whole thing, the project would not break even, B, Eversource has a profit threshold below which it will not go? If so, what is it? And C, is it something else?
The additional cost of underground construction is approximately $1 billion.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, please?
The additional cost of underground construction is approximately $1 billion if this were underground from beginning to end. We, along with our partners, are not prepared to move forward with a project that costs an additional $1 billion. In our view, it doesn't make sense financially.
Okay. Okay, this next one is, my family has worked for all three grand hotels between Whitefield and Dixville. Why would you pick an area with three grand hotels and not bury the line in that area?
So the areas that we've selected for burial are based upon feedback we received from across New Hampshire. So when we started to consider additional underground construction, we spent a lot of time across this state getting feedback as to, you know, what are the areas that we should really be focused on. Almost universally, we heard about the White Mountain National Forest, Franconian Notch, the Appalachian Trail. That's why we selected that area for underground construction.
Okay. I may not be able to read all of this question, but the first, there's a number of questions here. One of them you've already answered is why not bury the ground, bury it, the entire line. But the first one here is, where else in the United States, Canada, or Western Europe has a similar project of overhead DC lines combined with underground lines of both types? I don't. Through both rural and residential neighborhoods, been constructed and implemented. In other words, is there a project that closely parallels from which experience with post-construction problems can be studied?
I'll ask either Ken or Sam. Which one?
As Bill alluded to earlier, the 60 miles of underground on this program will end up being the longest installed cable in North America. There are a few AC cables that have been installed. I know of one in Connecticut. There's a couple in California. There are also undersea cables of a similar type of technology as we're using today. Obviously, they don't have the same characteristics of land use as we do in this project here. Typically, because of the expense of these projects, undersea cable is the only use of this type of DC technology.
So I'm familiar with an AC project that is similar in size and scope to this. It was approximately $2 billion. It occurred in the state of Connecticut. It had 36 miles of underground 345 kV AC, about 60 miles or less of overhead 345 kV AC. 33 total circuit miles of 138 kV submarine cable, and 22 miles of 115 kV underground cable. So the size and scope was similar in cost. It had transition stations, as this DC project does. It had some, I'd say, advanced technology. In this case, in the Connecticut project, a STATCOM was at one of the terminals. Similar to the technology of a converter station. This was a project that was completed by, at the time, Northeast Utilities, now Eversource Energy, and it was completed on schedule and under budget.
And just on the reliability issue, has been in service for over a decade at this point.
Why have you not considered going underground through the Pondicherry Wildlife Refuge if you don't plan to bury it everywhere? Pondicherry Wildlife Refuge, why aren't you burying it through that particular place?
So again, the area that we've committed to underground construction was based upon what I'll call statewide feedback. That's why we selected the area in and around the White Mountain National Forest. Sam, as far as the Pontichuk, could you repeat the area?
Pondicherry Wildlife Refuge.
Okay.
Pondicherry, Pondicherry.
Lee, are you familiar with that?
Hello, I'm Lee Carboneau with Normando Associates, and there is an existing transmission line through Pondicherry already. The Pondicherry area is relative to the portion of the White Mountains where the underground is going. It's much flatter. It is less likely to be visible from the trails that are commonly used. It is well on the northwest edge of Pondicherry. It doesn't go through the ponds or over those wetlands that are so famous for breeding birds and activities from visitors. So it's much less of a visual impact than what you would find in the overhead route through the White Mountain National Forest.
And the final question on this sheet goes back to the COAS loop. So why haven't you upgraded the COAS loop in the past if it has been inadequate for two decades? Isn't that your responsibility with or without Northern Pass?
In essence, what's caused the capacity situation on the COAS loop are the number of generators that have interconnected on the loop. It becomes the generator's responsibility to fund upgrades to existing transmission infrastructure. In this case, the generators who've interconnected with the loop have found it to be cost prohibitive to fund those upgrades. So we are now at a situation where the capacity is constrained. The studies that have been done historically have put a very big price tag on the cost of that upgrade, and no generator has been willing to pay for it. So this is an opportunity for us as part of this project to address that issue.